The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am excited to introduce our guests this evening. 50 years ago, next January, the National Liberation Front launched the fabled Tet Offensive, infiltrating and assuming control of the city of Hue, the intellectual and cultural capital of Vietnam. The battle that ensued over the next 24 days was the bloodiest and most costly in terms of American and Vietnamese lives lost during the war. In Hue, 1968, a turning point of the American war in Vietnam, Mark Bowden brings this harrowing and overwhelming battle back to life in page-turning You Were There detail, told through the stories of the men and women who served on both sides of the fight, a number of whom will join the author on stage later in the evening. In Sunday's New York Times, a reviewer wrote, Hue 1968 is a meticulous and vivid retelling of an important battle. Perhaps it will prompt a wider reflection on how to apply the lessons of Vietnam to our wars of today. Mark is the author of 13 books, including the number one New York Times bestseller, Black Hawk Down. He reported at the Inquirer for 20 years. It seems like old home week here for Inquirer reporters. And now writes for The Atlantic, Vanity Fair, and other magazines. He's also a writer in residence for the University of Delaware. Tonight, Mark will be interviewed by Bill Marimo, the former editor-in-chief of The Inquirer and The Baltimore Sun, and vice president of news for National Public Radio. For his work, he has received not one, but two Pulitzer Prizes, and as I expect many of you know, he is currently editor-at-large and vice president of The Inquirer's parent company. Please welcome Mark Bowden and Bill Marimo.
Well, we're glad to be here tonight. And before we begin, I wanted to tell you about the format. We're going to talk about three subjects. First of all, at Mark's request and mine, we want to talk about what the Philadelphia Inquirer has meant for us. Secondly, we're going to talk about the lessons learned from the Vietnam War, specifically the Battle of Hue. And then last but not least, we're going to talk about the reporting and writing of a really epic book, a book that, in my opinion, gives you a 360-degree analysis of what happened at Hue in 1968. This will take about 35 or 40 minutes. We'll reserve the rest of the hour for your questions and Mark's answers. So, Mark, take it away.
All right. Thank you very much, Bill. Bill and I have been talking about, reminiscing about our days at The Inquirer, and I can see in the audience some of my colleagues from The Inquirer, and I appreciate your coming out very much. Sometimes if you look back on your life, you realize that you were living through like one of the greatest times of your life and didn't know it. But I have to say that, you know, when I was at the Philadelphia Inquirer from 1979 on through into the 1990s, that it was, I knew that it was like the greatest place to be and that I was, you know, very, very fortunate to be working there. In fact, I would say, you know, the day that I was hired at the Inquirer, which was November 4th, 1979, was by far the most significant event in my professional life. It really gave me a lot of confidence in my ability to report and write, and I had a chance to work with and learn from some of the best journalists in the country. And I think I learned how to be a reporter and how to be a writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer. So everything that I've been doing since has really just been building on that base. So, and not to mention having the opportunity to work with colleagues like Bill. I know he's an important editor now of the paper, but back when we were working together, we were just hammering out stories for the Sunday paper. You were reminding me, Bill, of one that we did together.
on a Friday night in 1984, Mark was doing a magazine story about police corruption. And
not that there's any of that in Philadelphia.
And the real issue was whether or not police who observed a crime committed by a colleague would report the crime. And we did a really long story about the thin blue line and came to the conclusion, based on lots of interviews and lots of experience, that most police officers would not commit a crime, but if they saw someone assaulting someone else, it was very unlikely it would be reported.
Saw another cop assaulting somebody else, yeah.
But our years at the Inquirer were really golden years, mainly in part because of the leadership. And our editor, Gene Roberts, is there in the front row. The book, Hue 1968, is dedicated to Gene, who actually covered the Battle of Hue for the New York Times. And
it was also just purely serendipitous. I ran into Gene up in New York about 4 or 5 years ago, and he asked me what I was working on, and I told him, oh, I'm going to write a book about the Battle of Hue. And he said, well, I was there. And I mean, to me, he was just the editor, you know, he was my boss. And I had heard rumors that he was actually a pretty good reporter back in the day. It turned out he was a hell of a reporter. And actually, the first interview that I did in writing this book was down in Bath, North Carolina, at Gene and Sue's house. And Gene told me wonderful stories, all of which are in the book.
Well, just before we continue, Gene was truly a great reporter. He covered labor for the Detroit Free Press. He covered the civil rights movement for the New York Times. He covered Vietnam for the New York Times. He was the national editor of the New York Times, the editor of the Inquirer from 1972 to 1990, a terrific professor at Maryland. I watched him work his magic in class. Then he returned to the New York Times as the managing editor. And you'll have a chance to hear from Gene during the Q&A session. So Mark, let's talk about Hue 1968.
Sure.
I'm very interested, you know, given the fact that you dedicated 6 years of your life to this book. What are the history lessons and the political lessons?
Please talk into the mic.
Okay, I will talk into the mic, and I will articulate and project, as my 11th grade English teacher requested. So make sure to enunciate and project, Mark.
Yeah.
What are the history lessons that you've learned from reporting and writing your book? And what wisdom do you have given 2020 hindsight?
It's all in the book, Bill, so. I like most people in my generation, Vietnam was a very significant event. You know, less significant for me because I didn't go than for many of those who did and who I met and interviewed in the course of writing this book. But it remained throughout my life something that I remembered as a very traumatic ordeal, and in fact, it split my own family. I remember arguing with my father over the war in Vietnam. Both of us had really strong opinions. Neither of us knew very much, but it didn't stop us from having strong opinions. So, you know, this was my opportunity to, on my own, really investigate what happened in the war in Vietnam. And I would say that I was struck, first of all, by the enormous betrayal of the young Americans who were either drafted or who volunteered to fight in Vietnam and who underwent incredible ordeals, which I write about in this book, in many cases came home with terrible wounds, lost many of their good friends, a lot of these very, I think, decent, loyal Americans were killed in the Battle of Hue. And I think that they were fighting in a cause that, if you look back at the history of the war, by 1968, even the architects of the war had begun to no longer believe in it. I remember Jim Coolican, who was an officer who was a very prominent character throughout the story of the Battle of Hue, describing listening to Lyndon Johnson's speech in April or May of 1998. Actually, it was March. It was just a couple weeks after this battle happened, where he announced that he wasn't going to seek re-election. And he said he was going to basically devote his time to trying to get North Vietnam to negotiate an honorable peace. And Cooligan said he just felt that he knew at that moment that the United States was never going to prevail in the war in Vietnam, and reflected on all of the loss, all of the hardship, all of the struggle that he and his fellow Marines had gone through, and just felt that it was all being, you know, wasted. So that was the thing that really struck me. I think, too, you know, going to Vietnam, meeting NVA soldiers, Viet Cong soldiers, who are all the ones I interviewed at my age are older now, and they're looking back on this experience. I think what really struck me is how poorly the United States government understood what was going on in Vietnam when they committed this country to that cause. The tremendous variety of people who were engaged in fighting, the tremendous variety of reasons why. The very first person you meet in the book is Che Thi Mung, who was an 18-year-old village girl who was fighting for the Viet Cong. And Che Thi Mung's grandfather had fought with the Viet Minh against the French. Her father had fought with the Viet Minh. Her father had been arrested and imprisoned by the South Vietnamese government. Her older sister had been killed fighting the South Vietnamese army. And so for Che, at age 18, the war was her life. It was her family and her life. She was no more a communist than I am. You know, she was a village girl who had grown up fighting for the independence of her country. And I think just that one person's experience was enough to make me feel that the reasons why we got involved in Vietnam, the cause that we were fighting for, was not going to work. It was not popular with the Vietnamese people. So those are some of the things that really struck me.
Mark, one of the aspects of the book that I found intriguing was Mark actually got the tape-recorded conversations between President Johnson, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, Walter Rostow, General William Westmoreland. And I'm wondering, having listened to those tapes, having reconstructed the battle, how much responsibility did Lyndon Johnson have for the lies that he ended up telling the American public and for the gross miscalculations of the generals?
You know, I think that Johnson is kind of a tragic figure in all this because he inherited the war from the Kennedy administration, and he also kind of inherited the Kennedy agenda. And the war in Vietnam was one that he felt, I think, obliged to pursue, even though there's some doubt as to whether Kennedy himself would have increased American involvement before he was assassinated. But Johnson, much like the current resident of the White House, trusted his generals implicitly. It was a time in American history when generals were accorded a tremendous amount of respect. The United States had come off World War II as a victor and had been successful, at least in Korea. And I think in American society in the 1950s and 60s, you know, a four-star general was an extraordinarily respected figure, as he should be. But in Johnson's case, I don't think he brought any military experience of his own. And he also, I think, was prone to, as many people in charge are, liking to hear what he wanted to hear. So when he passed along what turned out to be false information, which I think was the responsibility of the generals who were serving him, General Westmoreland chief among them, I think he was badly served by these generals, and I think he believed them. And so I don't think that he stood up in front of the American public and consciously lied to them. I think he believed what he was being told, and he was, I think, really determined to be successful, and that's what I think led us to get in deeper and deeper and deeper.
And one more question, Mark, about the lessons of the war.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to me, after reading it, that it was an incredible failure of intelligence.
Yeah.
To have 500 Marines confronting 10,000 NVA-trained, tough soldiers.
Right.
How could the U.S. intelligence have failed that abysmally?
Well, I think it's because the movement in South Vietnam had a lot more support from the populace than the United States was willing to believe. You can't, I mean, you talk about what happened after the city of Hue was taken. In the preceding 3 or 4 months before the Battle of Hue began, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong amassed an army of 10,000 outside of the city, and no alarms went off with the South Vietnamese army or with the American army. I mean, that is one of the most extraordinary intelligence failures of modern times, and it couldn't have happened without a lot of the people, particularly in the rural areas, the Vietnamese people, choosing not to sound an alarm when this happened. And then the compounding the intelligence failure was General Westmoreland's refusal to believe the facts. The city had been taken in the first day. He actually had a CIA report on his desk outlining exactly the conditions in the city, that it was completely owned by the enemy, and that there were only these two small compounds that were besieged. And yet Westmoreland told the press and cabled to the White House and the Joint Chiefs of Staff that there was no real problem in Hue, there were only a few hundred enemy soldiers in the city, and that the Marines had the situation well in hand. Well, that attitude is what prompted the generals who served under Westmoreland to order these small companies of Marines to attack, you know, a well-entrenched, far superior enemy, and they were just getting creamed. And they would send, they would radio back what was actually happening, you know, with their men. And I'm not just saying this because I think this is what happened. I'm talking to these Marines who were young company captains serving at the time, who retired, by the way, as brigadier generals from the Marine Corps. So they are not, you know, your standard anti-war pacifists, you know. But they're saying that the orders that they were being given were suicidal, and yet they were being ordered to do it. And I think that all grew out of a sense of denial at the highest level. Basically, General Westmoreland refused to believe what had happened because, in his theory, it couldn't.
Let's turn now a little bit to the reporting and the writing of the book. I gather at the outset you're only tepidly inspired by the subject.
Well, it was suggested to me, and I had written a book about a battle before, and I know what an undertaking that is. And I also am not, even though I now have written a number of books on military topics, I'm the last thing in the world from a military expert. But so I was a little reluctant to delve back into it. But I did, at my publisher's behest, begin to read up a little bit about the Battle of Hue. And I also started to reflect on the role that Vietnam had played in my life and in the life of the country. And the more I thought about it and the more I learned, I was convinced that Hue, the Battle of Hue, would provide a very dramatic lens through which you could, in a sense, tell the story of the entire war in Vietnam. I'm not the sort of historian to sit down and write a 7-volume history of the war in Vietnam, but if you give me a good story to tell, which the Battle of Hue was, I can use that as a lens on the much larger experience. And I found that just about every factor of the Vietnam War, military and political, came into play in that battle. I think that there's hardly an issue that the United States and the Vietnamese faced in that war that doesn't add to or doesn't become part of that story, including the role that journalists played. And I should add, you know, I've made a point of how badly General Westmoreland misled the president and misled the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the American public. At the same time that General Westmoreland was saying there was nothing going wrong in Hue, Gene Roberts went to Hue, was the first reporter in the city, landed in the Marine compound, which was besieged. And believe me, I've done enough foreign reporting to know how hard it is to parachute into some place and quickly figure out what's going on. And yet it took Gene all of about 4 or 5 hours to realize that these Marines who were trapped in this outpost couldn't get more than a half block out in any direction. And so it was apparent that they were surrounded and outnumbered. And he managed to get out, fly back, and write a story which ran on page one of the New York Times on February 3rd. This is just 2 or 3 days after the city was taken, which basically said that the enemy owned the city and the Marines were outnumbered and surrounded. It was the only reason why the American public had a clue what was really going on.
That's great. In the opening of Mark's book, he describes two young women who spend a great deal of their time doing surveillance of the Marine base in Wei and watching the movements of the troops when they're on patrol, when they're not. I wondered, Mark, how you unearthed those two women and you know, how you got to know them, how you interviewed them,
right,
and how you chose to begin the book with the two of them.
Well, you know, I knew that at some point, in order to write the kind of book I wanted to write, I had to tell the story from both sides. And yet, I have never been to Vietnam. I don't speak a lick of Vietnamese, and I didn't really know what to do. But I've, you know, this is what reporting teaches you. And I can remember at the Enquirer, you know, Gene sending me off to Africa to write a series of stories about the threatened extinction of the black rhino, and, you know, landing in Africa without a clue how to go about reporting it, but basically having to figure it out. And, you know, that's what being a journalist is. So for me, I started looking for someone in Vietnam who could help me. And I called up to Dartmouth because I read of a Dartmouth professor who wrote a lot, studied Southeast Asia. And I asked him who he used as a translator and a fixer when he went to Vietnam. And he mentioned this fellow named Dang Hoa Ho. So turns out that Dang Hoa Ho had been working with Ken Burns on the documentary that will air on PBS later this year. So he came very highly recommended by Lynn Novick, who is the producer of that series. And so what I did was I hired Hoa to initially plunge into the archives in Hanoi and find what he could from the Vietnamese perspective about the battle. And I also asked him to begin finding Vietnamese who fought in that battle. Hoa is a retired military officer. He's much too young to have fought in the American War, but he knows his way around the military in Vietnam, and he was able to find these people for me. So when I first went to Vietnam in 2015, you know, he set up a two-week-long itinerary for me where I basically interviewed 2 and 3 people a day for sometimes 2 and 3 hours at a time. Most of the time not understanding what they're saying, because Hoa is giving me a very quick translation of sometimes very long answers. But then when I got home, I hired a young woman at the University of Delaware, a Vietnamese woman, Xuyen Dinh, who undertook the task of transcribing and translating and transcribing all of the interviews. So it was really only when I got back and had a chance to read in detail what all these people were saying that I hit upon Che Ti Mung and this other young woman, who I was struck by how young they were and how they had become involved in fighting against the United States Marines. I had already done a lot of interviewing with American soldiers and Marines, and many of them were only 18 or 19 years old themselves. And so here was their counterpart in Vietnam, only it wasn't even a man, it was a young woman who was fighting against them. I just found that to be so striking. And also Che is a wonderful storyteller. She rode up to her interview with me on a motorcycle. Everybody in Hue rides motor scooters. And she's about, you know, now maybe 67, a couple years older than me. She's has a teenage daughter, who she had very late in life because she fought for many years. After the war, she was trained to be an optometrist, and she works now as an optometrist in Hue. But she was fascinating and a wonderful storyteller. So after I read everything that she had to say to me, I also met one of her friends who survived the battle and interviewed her. When I went back to Vietnam and a year later in 2016, I went back to them and interviewed them more because I had decided that I was going to really try and tell their stories, you know, as part of the book. And that, in a nutshell, you know, is how I managed to find all those Vietnamese characters and learn their stories.
I'm interested, for those of you who had a chance to read Black Hawk Down, it was the story of the Battle of Mogadishu in the Somalian conflict. And I'm interested in terms of the degree of difficulty of interviewing the other side in Somalia versus in Vietnam.
It was harder in Somalia. In Vietnam, most of the people I was talking to were older. You know, this battle happened 50 years ago. They had had a long life to reflect on their experiences. The war was one in which they were victorious, and so they're very proud of their service, and they were eager, you know, to tell me their stories. So the logistics were the same level of difficulty, although it was harder, frankly, to get to Mogadishu than it was to fly into Vietnam. In Mogadishu, I was dealing with people who had fought against American soldiers just 2 or 3 years earlier. And, you know, a lot of people who came to me were lying. You know, they would tell me very fanciful stories because they thought it would be fun, I guess, to fool the American. But I had done so much interviewing of American soldiers that I had a fairly good grasp of that battle. And so, if, for instance, a Somali told me how he single-handedly destroyed a tank, I knew that there were actually no tanks involved in the battle. So I would whisk that person out as fast as I could. But in either case, I mean, in both cases, it's always difficult to interview people in translation. In the case of the Vietnam book, I was able to go back a second time and really sit down with a lot of the same people and ask follow-up questions and really learn, and in some cases even exchange email with them later on through the assistance of my translator. So it was a little bit easier doing it this time.
Mark, are there any good books written by the Vietnamese about the American War and the Battle of Hue, books that you relied on at all or read?
I did. One of the Vietnamese generals, General Kinh, wrote a memoir, and I used it in describing the preparations just before launching the attack on Hue. And he is a wonderful storyteller. He describes scenes in detail of them, you know, peering out over the dark city at night, waiting for the first shots to be fired, and wondering why, you know, things weren't happening. He managed to create a fairly dramatic moment. So that was an excellent one. And then the other one that really, two other books really influenced me. One was written by Nguyen Dac Huan, who is an esteemed Buddhist professor in Hue, who during the Battle of Hue was a young Buddhist who had volunteered to fight with the Viet Cong and became a propagandist for them, and then helped to lead troops into the city. And once the city was taken, one of the main goals of the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong was to hunt down anyone in Hue who had worked for the South Vietnamese government in whatever capacity and round them up, many of whom were later executed. So Huan, in his book, described his idealism joining the Viet Cong. He is a Buddhist, so he's, you know, ostensibly a pacifist, but he found himself caught up in these executions and purges that began to happen, and ended up being horrified by what this revolution that he had signed on for was actually accomplishing, what it was actually doing. And there's a scene in the book which is drawn from both his book and my interview with him, where he's pleading to try to save the lives of men who he was friends with growing up, and who he knew were not traitors to the country. But as the book tries to explain, the purges got accelerated and accelerated. It just became a very horrible phenomenon that got out of control. And the last book is a book called Morning Headband for Hui, which has been translated into English, and I strongly recommend it. And it's by a young, then a young Vietnamese woman who wrote about her experiences as a civilian in Hue during the battle. And she's a wonderful writer and goes through just a tremendous ordeal with her family while this battle is being fought. I drew a lot on her account, and it helped me understand how devastating this battle was to the residents of Hue and how trapped they felt by the fighting.
Mark, my last question before we turn to our company is, have you heard from some of the Marines that you interviewed or families of the Marines who died in battle at Hue since publication of the book?
I've heard a lot from a lot of them. In fact, before the book was finished, I sent manuscripts out to a number of the key people who were involved in the fighting. And I mentioned it earlier, the company, Marine company captains who later retired as generals. So I call them my generals now, you know. Mike Downs, Chuck Meadows, who actually retired as a colonel, Ron Christmas, who retired as a general. And then there was Charles Crone, who was an army colonel with the 2nd of the 12th, who fought on the outskirts of the city. And Howard Prince, who was with another 1st Cav unit that fought on the outskirts of the city. And they have all played a very big role in vetting my manuscript and criticizing me in advance so that I can make corrections and improvements before the book comes out. And then since then, yes, I've heard from a great many of the people I've written about. Some of them I've been traveling around talking about the book, and they generally come out in this, some have this evening, to be there. And they're so far, all the people that I've been writing about are thrilled with the way the book tells the story. I haven't heard from family members of people who died. I have heard indirectly through some of my wide circle of friends now who fought in the Battle of Hue, but not anyone. I probably will. It's only been out a month. So, okay.
Well, with that, we're going to maybe introduce the
Right, I think Eddie Neese is here, and Carl DeLeo, Eddie?
Okay. Maybe they could come up.
Would you want to come up on stage with us? And Gene,
could you join us, please?
Thanks for coming, Carl. Nice to see you. Eddie, great to see you again. Good to have you. Just choose a chair. Gene, you can come up.
Yep. So there'll be a couple people on each side with microphones. And
if I could take a minute, I'd like to introduce the folks that are here.
Please do, Mark.
Eddie Neese is a Marine, as you might be able to tell by the regalia. he was in the thick of the fighting inside the city of Hue, mostly in southern Hue and south side, and so personally witnessed a lot of the very difficult fighting that took place south of the Huang River. Carl DeLeo was with the 2nd of the 12th, the 1st Cav Division, and I've actually been asked to read this passage, Carl, which came from you, about you in your foxhole waiting for the mortars to fall. And there's some very harrowing moments in the story, which I owe Carl to knowing about. Yeah. You know, and people often say to me, you know, in fact, I was just asked this question the other day. This young writer who should have known better said, you know, when do you as a writer start to embellish the facts? And I said, well, you know, I genuinely try not to embellish the facts. He says, well, how can you know what was going on in Carl DeLeo's head when he was in that trench and the mortars were falling around him? And I said, well, I happened to sit and talk to Carl and felt the fine hairs raised in the back of my neck, you know, as he was telling me about it. So, and Gene, of course, we've already introduced to you, and I can't say enough about how impressive Gene's reporting was from the middle of this maelstrom. Incredibly brave to be there, number one, and secondly, to have the wits to figure out what was going on and write intelligently about it, and I might add, capture wonderful color Everything from the duck that wandered through the marine outpost that everyone was eyeing for dinner to wonderful little details. And I want you, Gene, to tell the story of the guy who you ran into from your hometown, who you had interviewed from your hometown newspaper, or who remembered you as a reporter from the Ramblin' and Rural Wayne column. Do you remember that story? You climbed into the bunker?
Right. I started my career as a farm reporter. As close to the ground as you could get. And I wrote a column in a very agricultural county called Ramblin' and Rural Wayne, which was all about the latest cotton blossom, the first tobacco harvest, things that were important to farmers. And then 10 years later, I find myself in the middle of a battle in Hue, Vietnam. And each day, the Marines take a block only to have the Viet Cong infiltrate back in during the night, and they have to take it all over again. And it took them several days to get 10 or 15 blocks out. And when they did, they found a group of Americans huddled under the house. These were advisors, some military, some civilian. And they'd crawled under the house to escape the ravages of the Tet Offensive with just a few cans of food, almost no water. And they survived for a few days. And as you can imagine, they were pretty shook up when the Marines broke through. And the Marines took them out from under the house, took them to the main military compound, and to calm them, put them in the deepest bunker in the compound, which was basically a tunnel in the ground. And I heard that that they were in the bunker, and I went over to interview them, had to crawl over sandbags and then to a little tunnel, and I rounded a bin, and I saw some figures over there, and I said, "I'm Gene Roberts. I'm with the New York Times. I've come to get your story." And out of the darkness came this voice, and it said, "Hey, did you ever write the Ramblin' and Rural Wayne column for the Goldsboro News Argus?" It's a small world.
So
out
there. I think we should, Eddie, you want to just say a few words about your experiences? Just a few, because we want to be able to answer questions.
And I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York, and I turned 19 3 weeks before I went into Way City. I was a Lance Corporal machine gunner with Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 1st Marines. And we were, at the end of January, were in a town called the city, Quang Tri, and our battalion was moved in south on the 30th of January to Phu Bai. On 31 January is when Tet Offensive happened. Part of my platoon and two officers from the company was stuck at Quang Tri because of a transportation snafu. We didn't get down to Phu Bai until the following day, and we had learned that Captain Batchelor had taken whatever was left of Alpha Company down at Phu Bai into Way City to basically go check out what was going on. The intel was terrible. And I got to say something about the intel. We're looking back on a battle that happened 49 years ago. And we've got all the intel now, all the reports, all the experience and knowledge that we have gained, and we can answer these battles in two different ways, at 19 years old or at 68 years old as I am today, which is no different than could we have prevented 9/11? They knew that was going to happen. The Tet Offensive, they all knew that the battle was going to happen. They just didn't know where, or as Westmoreland thought, it was going to be Khe Sanh. It was not. World War II, they knew the Japanese were going to do something. They couldn't stop that. So I have a lot more about the battle, and I'll turn it over
to Carl.
I'm Carl Dillia from Trenton, New Jersey. I'm 69 years old. I was a sergeant in the infantry, and Ed was in the south part of the city. We were the northwest outskirts, and our unit was cut off and surrounded and really almost annihilated. And it was a kind of the intelligence, which you really hit right on the head. So we lost half of our men. We had 500 men. We lost like 250 the first day, you know, killed or wounded. Ran out of ammunition and managed to escape at night and get out of there. But just went right back into the same battle for the next 25 days. But I was like Ed, I mean, there were good experiences and bad experiences for me, but there were experiences, and you know, I wouldn't trade it.
Absolutely. You should hang on to that, Carl. All right.
All right, so I think we have some microphones in the back. So I'll take some, starts with some questions.
Well, I'd just like to add a note. I was in the 525th Military Intelligence Group up on the Cambodian border. And right. And we were, our task was strategic intelligence. We were running agents into Cambodia and Laos and everything. But I had a top secret clearance and I could follow the intelligence all the way up to Saigon. And it was changed at every level. And I went into Saigon about a week or so before the Tet Offensive, and somebody set off some firecrackers, and I went under the table, and everybody at the table was laughing at me. You know, and I said, well, where I was, everybody was a Viet Cong. And, but you could not convince the command in Saigon. And I have to say just one added point that I went to Army Language School to study French, actually, and in Washington before going to Vietnam in 67. And one of the members of my class was a military attaché who was a colonel who had been head of White House communications, and he was going to be sent to a post in Africa. And he said he regularly went over to the Pentagon, and he said that the Pentagon had already decided that Westmoreland was a hopeless loser, and they were going to send General Abrams to replace him. And so I got there, and then after the Tet Offensive, the Army could not admit that they'd made a mistake, and so they kept Westmoreland there longer. He was absolutely clueless. And so it was not I don't think it was a question of intelligence being bad. I think it was a question of it simply being distorted. Mm. And at one point I was talking with a colonel, and he said to my boss, he said, you cannot allow him to tell me that. And I said, you know, it's not me who's telling you that. It's reality. Mm. And I think we've run into the same problem in Iraq and now, you know, certainly very much now. And so I think, Mark, you weren't there, but I think your account is absolutely right on target.
Thank you.
And
First, thank you both for your service and for fighting for us. And Mark, thank you for telling their story. My question is, Gene, too, forgive me, the original source.
Yes.
So, you know, I think when most people, myself included, think of Vietnam, you think of fighting in the jungle. This was obviously largely an urban battle, or sounds like it. I haven't made all the way through the book yet. Apologies, Mark. Mm-hmm. So my question is, how well equipped were the U.S. forces and how well equipped were the enemy to fight in an urban environment? And what did the Marine Corps and the Army take from that that might have helped us down the road?
The Marines had no experience fighting in the city. And, you know, even Marines like Eddie, who had been in Vietnam for a while, had not been fighting in an urban environment. One of my favorite chapters in the book is how Ernie Cheatham, the lieutenant colonel who was put in charge of the Marines' effort in Southern Hue after the first 4 or 5 days, actually went hunting for Marine Corps manuals about how to fight in an urban environment. And he spent the whole night before going into Hue boning up on tactics and weaponry that he would need. But the Marines and the Army were very hampered by a couple things. The city took away a lot of the big advantages that American forces had, which is air power and artillery. Inside the city, there was a tremendous concern, interestingly, not so much about killing people, but about destroying historic treasures, at least initially. And the weather in that time of year in Vietnam is so overcast that when Carl's unit out fighting on the outskirts of the city in rice paddies and tree stands were unable to get air power and artillery, and yet were being ordered to attack anyway. So it was like taking American infantry units and taking away their advantage, which was artillery and air power, which gave, you know, the Vietnamese a chance to sort of, for once, sort of duke it out on a more even level. And so they didn't have any more experience of fighting in cities, I think, than Americans did, but they felt they could do a better job because they weren't getting hammered from the air.
I got to add something to that. Prior to the Marines going over to Vietnam, they were sent to a training facility at Camp Pendleton called Staging Battalion. And that's where they indoctrinated you, gave you lessons supposedly on jungle operations, jungle warfare, fighting in the rice paddies and the sand dunes. I was in Vietnam for 6 months. They basically told me that the NVA or the Viet Cong have black pajamas and the good guys have white pajamas. Now, I landed at Da Nang. I jumped on a truck to go to a city called Hoi An, where my battalion was at the time. And there's guys with black pajamas and guys with white pajamas running around the city, and nobody's shooting at them, right? I couldn't understand that, right? So that was a little fallacy of what it was told at Staging Battalion. I fought in the jungles and the rice paddies for 6 months. I go in the Way City, house-to-house fighting. Today they use the term urban combat, right? Clearing room by room. The Marines, you know, use all these acronyms, adapt and overcome. The difference was we were led well. I had 3 second lieutenants lead Alpha Company through the battle after our company commander went down. And they said, instead of going, take that hill, take that building, take that floor, take that room. So if you saw all the pictures on Way City, a number of the Marines and corpsmen inside the city don't have packs on. The company commander told Alpha Company going in the first day, oh, we got to go check it out. We'll be back by lunch. Yeah. One of my buddies in my platoon, John Legato, who went in on day one, didn't even put socks on because he figured he'd be back by noon. So it was really a situation where you adapt, you overcame, and you just did what you were trained to do in a different environment.
You know, people often ask me how I get people to talk to me and tell me their stories. And the answer to the question is you show up.
All right. Yes, sir. Right here. Second row, please.
Mark, thanks so much. You're still the world's greatest storyteller. It's really wonderful reading your book. I'd like to ask the two veterans, when did you go into military service because you wanted to fight in the war, or were you drafted? And what was it like afterwards when you came home?
Yeah, I volunteered for the draft, so I wanted to go, and I wanted to be in the infantry, and I wanted to be in the war. So after the war, I mean, with all everything that went on and what happened to us, it definitely knocks you off askew. And I don't think your life is ever on the plane that it was supposed to take. But, you know, it is what it is, so you can't change it. But
Carl, talk for a minute about why you wanted to go fight.
I was probably from that generation where our fathers were in the Second World War, and I'm watching John Wayne movies, and I'm 18 years old, and you figure you're immortal. I mean, nothing's going to kill you. And me and Ed were talking about it. Yeah. And that changes the first day over there, you know, you're not going to, you know, immortal. But all in all, you know, I'm glad that I went. You know, I'm not glad what happened on both sides. But, you know, what happened happened, so here we are.
On my 17th birthday, January 4th, 1966, I got up and I enlisted in the Marine Corps. I was in boot camp 17 days later. That does not happen today. It takes 9 months to go into the military. I quit high school as a sophomore in October of 65, And school wasn't working out, so I figured, well, I'm going to go be a Marine. And I want to go to Vietnam, and I want to shoot at somebody, and I want them to shoot at me. I wanted to experience what I saw on TV, not realizing what it really felt like and looked like, right? So I did my time in Vietnam. I got out in 1969, and because I had done what I wanted to do at 16, 17, 18 years old, I moved right back into being a, you know, getting a job and going about my business. I was proud of what I did. A lot of guys I hung out with were proud of what they did. Went to work for the phone company in Brooklyn, New York, and in 1976, I went back into reserves, and I stayed there for 25 years until I retired with 30. So I was proud of what I did, and I would do it over in a heartbeat.
I joined as well out of high school, 7 days out of high school. I was a 19-year-old and ended up in Vietnam in Pleiku area as a radio direction finder. They used to throw me, I had a top secret clearance. They used to throw me on a mountaintop with other, when we'd triangulate and send guys like you out there to get them. My question, I've also been a reporter in my life here in Philadelphia and elsewhere, and I've also been for many, many years in the anti-war movement. I've been to Iraq as an anti-war person during the war. And my question is, you know, you talked about the betrayal of draftees, a very important betrayal. And you talk about an intelligence failures, all very, very real. My issue is the moral question. How we got there, why we got there. Truman, 1945, I'm sure you know the history. You know, and how we decide to do this. I mean, in my view, we betrayed the Vietnamese in what we did in 1945 when Truman chose to support the French in recolonizing Vietnam, and that was the beginning. And I know.
Thank you for your question. You know, it is a big question, and I have to say that, you know, my approach as a journalist is to try to tell the story and try to capture the experience that those who were caught up in this event had. I don't myself try to preach to my readers, you know, what, you know, how they should think necessarily about it, although I do at the end of the book write an epilogue where I draw my own thoughts about what's happened from what I've learned in what I've written. And I think, you know, one of the things that really struck me, and I wrote about this in the epilogue, was the lack of concern and also the lack of understanding for the citizens of Hue. Because particularly in the northern part of that city, which is a fort, it's a citadel, there are only 9 ways in and out. The people who lived, and there were hundreds of thousands, not hundreds of thousands, many, many tens of thousands of people who lived inside that citadel, and they were trapped. They literally had nowhere to go. So later in the battle, when American and South Vietnamese forces were dropping napalm and bombs and using heavy artillery in order to help the Marines advance, I think that took a tremendous toll on the civilians in Hue. And I should add, so did the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, who, after they took the city, were very deliberately rounding people up and executing them. So there is enough blame and horror, you know, to go around for just about everyone involved in this battle. And as I said earlier, I think if you dig deeply, as I've done, into this one event, you see all of these issues coming into play in this one particular place.
My question is, good evening, by the way, folks. My question is, between the propaganda of the war and actual police power of Vietnam, when did the propaganda become more of a play within the Vietnam War? And was it before 1961?
You know, I researched the Battle of Hue, and I can say, you know, on the North Vietnamese side, they were very, very badly misled by their own propaganda. You know, the propagandists in Hanoi believed that when their troops moved into the city, that the people of Hue would rise up and fight with them against the South Vietnamese army and against Americans. And that didn't happen. And a lot of the Vietnamese troops who went into the city knew that that wasn't going to happen. But, you know, propaganda played a big role there. And I think, to some extent, the refusal of General Westmoreland to face facts on the ground was part of what, I don't know whether he would have formally labeled it propaganda, but it was certainly misinformation. And there was a great deal of misinformation about not just what was happening in Hue, but also what was happening, you know, in the war at large, I mean, all through our involvement there.
Thanks for all of that. It's really been a fascinating evening. Mark, it's a question for you. I wanted to know whether you've given any thought to the difference between being a journalist and being an historian. Mm. For example, you're writing about events that took place 50 years ago, and you interview your brigadier generals and the optometrists in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and it's very tempting to think that one is speaking directly to the 1960s, mm-hmm. though of course one is not, because all of those people have re-remembered all of those events and recreated them, and their lives have gone in different directions. And I wanted to know whether you had any experience in how to correct for a problem that doesn't arise when we're doing journalism, mm-hmm. but that does arrive when we're doing history.
Right. It's a good question, and I do try to make the distinction, and I explain in the end of the book that I am a journalist, and I use some of the tools of an historian. I go to the archives, I try to look for the historical record, but I'm aware, you know, that I'm building an account primarily on the recollections of people who were involved. So much time has gone by, clearly people's memories are not always correct, but when you interview as many people as I do before I write these stories, you get an opportunity to bounce one person's memory off of another's. And if there's an ample historical record, which there is with the Battle of Hue, you can also take these individual accounts and see how they jibe with what the historical record is. But I would say that, you know, there are limitations with journalism just as there are with history. You know, I know if you go back and read any one of the 500 biographies of Abraham Lincoln that exist, many of them base a lot of the stories that they have to tell on the work of journalists that was done in the years after Lincoln was killed. So the accounts of people, even if those accounts are not always 100% accurate, but the memories of people who were there, who experienced the thing, who knew the person, remain valuable. So I believe that a journalistic account, a careful one, can be as important a contribution in the long run to our understanding, and makes a valuable contribution to the work that historians do.
All right, well, thank you all for being a great audience.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.